The topic on which I'm speaking today is actually the title of a paper that is headed for publication in the Journal of Law and Religion. I want to mention the journal because I am the book review editor, so I would be remiss if I did not bring it to your attention. The publication of this article is currently scheduled for the spring 2013 issue, which, given the slow progress of academic publication, probably means it will come out late summer or fall. But if anyone is interested and would like a copy, I would be happy to email it to you after the conference. I should also say that this project has a beginning at the Center for the Study of Law and Religion, where I was a fellow from 2007 to 2010, in a project on law, religion, and human rights, which I was fortunate to be able to pursue with Johan Bundefaver and John Whitty. That project ended up leading to another project, Sharia, Family, and Democracy in Nigeria and Beyond, and some of you here have participated in that project as well. My paper today is also part of a larger project that I'm working on that's now a book proposal for Oxford and hopefully editorial publication. That is called Religion, Rights, and the Recognition of Identity. And I'll say more about why identity has become central to my work a bit later. But the focus of my paper today is actually in three countries, Kenya, Tanzania, and Zambia. Selected because when I came upon this topic, they were all in various stages of planning to having recently had constitutional referenda. And the idea of having a referendum on a constitution was sort of inherently interesting to me as an American. We think of referenda as ways to introduce very specific and often controversial topics. But the idea of democracy proceeding in that way with the entire country voting on a constitution was very interesting. I do want to say also that it reflects some of the themes that did come out of that earlier project on law, religion, and human rights at Emory, and some of these themes echo what was said this morning. This conference was in Durban. It featured mostly lawyers and one lone pastor from the Congo, who came together to map out the terrain of law, religion, and human rights in Africa. And the first thing that I observed that was very interesting and conjures up Bishop Mwamba's notion of the lawyer with the history and literature books on his or her shelves was that while the conference was on law and all of our participants had prepared papers on law, it very quickly departed from law and turned to religion, politics, culture. I saw lawyers morphing before my eyes into anthropologists and sociologists. The second thing that came out of this discussion, which has also been alluded to by all of our previous speakers, is this interaction of law, religion, and politics in Africa, which, again, is very different from an American perspective, but as many of you know, religion is never separate from our politics, but we are very devoted to that idea of church-state separation. The fourth major point that really dominated this earlier conference was a prolonged discussion of the interaction of Christians and Muslims in Africa, which was described as a competition of monotheisms in which each religion tried to sort of sharpen its message to appeal to potential adherents, and in ways that often led to very doctrinally orthodox notions of the faith. This ended up taking up quite a bit of our discussion. But there was one particular part of our conference, one particular topic of discussion that really captivated me, and this was when attention turned to the notion of hate speech. And it was in the context of our sort of taking stock of where we've been that day, of what message we needed to take back to the U.S. about law, religion, and human rights in Africa. And the topic turned to hate speech, and particularly hate speech against religion. And the way in which America, exceptional in many ways, is exceptionally, absolutely devoted to freedom of speech. And my interlocutors at our conference in Durban said, no, you Americans are far too absolutist. In our multi-ethnic, multicultural, multilingual, multi-religious societies, speech can quickly go awry if it tends in the direction of hate. So you may need to moderate your understanding of the relationship between religious freedom and the freedom of speech. Finally, this whole hate speech conversation and also this intense interest in the competition between Christianity and Islam seem to suggest something about the fragility of our human communities. That there's always this potential for conflict, which if not managed, can erupt in ways that we don't want. So as I looked at constitutionalism in Africa, beginning with the Kenyan constitutional referendum in 2010, I noticed that many, particularly on the American side and internationally, feared that Kenya would devolve into utter chaos. It had its presidential elections in 2007, which erupted into terrible violence in early 2008, and everyone was predicting very dire consequences for the Kenyan referendum. Well, the good thing was that it turned out very well. It proceeded peacefully and was a remarkable democratic success against the odds and against the prevailing opinion. But it did raise this question, that fear of social hostility erupting. And what I want to say here, and this is in particular connection with the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life and its various reports which have already been mentioned, the 2009 report on global religious restrictions, the 2011 report on rising religious restrictions, and especially their 2010 report on tolerance and tension, Christianity and Islam in Africa. The Pew Forum, with many other observers of religious freedom, has increasingly distinguished between violations of religious freedom that are meted out by the government, and so have to do with the law. This is the state doing it. In comparison with those violations of religious freedom that come from social hostility against religion, which can include anything from hate speech to government-sponsored forms of conflict to outright genocide in some cases. This whole area of social hostilities really seemed to open up the idea of religious freedom and human rights much more in the direction of these very important conversations that we had at the earlier conference in Durban. So there was one other thing that came across my desk in reference to Kenya that really put this issue of something very interesting going on with respect to religion and constitutionalism in Africa on my radar screen. I read about a very interesting initiative that was created by a communications person with some technical skills called Katiba Mobi, which was a means by which Kenyans could access the proposed constitution, provision by provision, on the small screen of their telephones, in both English and Kiswahili, which is very accessible in Africa, where the mobile phone plays the role of the internet in other parts of the world, and is a key place where people both access information and exchange information. It's very much a social medium. And the mobile phone initiative was connected to a website which actually collected data about who was accessing what among these constitutional provisions that were being delivered over the phone. How many hits did they get? What were some of the searches that people would then go to the website if they had internet access to do about the new constitution? And there were the sort of top 10 issues that leapt out involved a number of things. There was something about teachers, I'm not sure what that was about. Abortion, always very controversial. Land reform, a big issue in Kenya. But there were five that made it into my calculation of the top 10. Religion, marriage, and then three various kinds of references to the Qadi courts, the Muslim courts of personal law. So I looked at that, and this made me realize that religion, religious freedom, and especially this issue of religious and legal pluralism, or juridical pluralism, as someone calls it, was playing a big role in the sort of public consideration of the Kenyan constitution. Now, at the same time, there were many who were also mobilizing in society specifically against that constitution, among other reasons, but perhaps above all, because of this sense that they were going to reaffirm Section 66 of the Kenyan Constitution, which gives recognition to constitutional courts. In fact, a religious leader, Christian Jesse Kamau, and 25 others filed suit at the Kenyan High Court, challenging the proposed reaffirmation of Section 66 as a violation of equal protection and religious freedom. The Kamau decision famously said that, yes, this was in fact a violation of religious freedom, that these courts were not constitutionally mandated. However, when the referendum was actually held, the Constitution was approved, and therefore Section 66 allowing the Qadi's courts to exist was reaffirmed as well. So the referendum overturned this very important 100-page, I might say, Kenyan Supreme Court decision. Now, as I looked at Kenya, mostly because of the current, at that time, current constitutional referendum that was before me, Kenya, by the most recent statistics, is 88% Christian, 11% Muslim. So, you know, this is an example of the kind of concern about Muslim courts that can happen, one can say, in a majority Christian society. I wonder what this would look like in a more mixed society. Tanzania has been scheduled for a while now, and is still scheduled to have a constitutional referendum. It too has had issues around the Qadi courts, sometimes and more often in concert with the question of sovereignty for Zanzibar. Zanzibar, of course, is the mostly Muslim island province of Tanzania, which was united with mainland Tanganyika. And there has been always been a sort of undercurrent of yearning for sovereignty, but it's an undercurrent that's become much more powerful in recent years. In fact, just this past fall, in October and November, there were actually riots in Zanzibar over the sovereignty issue. So this, too, is a place where this question of Qadi courts, Muslim-Christian coexistence is playing a major role in constitutional referenda. Those are two different societies, one mostly Christian, one more mixed. I wanted a foil, and Zambia was my foil. It was having presidential elections in 2011. It has also had delayed referenda, and more importantly, has expressed many fears in recent years about the rise of Islam in its society. So, what I want to say about this, and I'll say it very briefly, we can get into specifics later, the Pew data contain an enormous reservoir, repository of information about contemporary African attitudes, especially in the area of Muslim-Christian relations. And I started looking at the Pew data and comparing it to what I was reading was going on with respect to the constitutional referenda. What I ended up focusing on in the Pew data in great detail, and again, I can send you the paper, is the place where different countries were outliers. Where did they sort of stand out looking different from all the rest? I'll give you an example. Kenya, for example, had a very high number, disproportionately high number of Christians reporting Muslim hostility. There were high perceptions of ethnic and national conflict, which are a separate question in Pew from religious conflict, but the two often dovetail. So to see high perceptions of ethnic and national conflict in Kenya was important. Kenya had the lowest percentage of people satisfied with the way things were going in their country, in their politics. The Muslims in Kenya had some of the highest perceptions of very negative characteristics, violence, selfishness, immorality, that they have ascribed to Christians. Just a few more before I wind to a conclusion here. An example that has captivated me from Tanzania is that there is a very high level of social distrust in that society. At the same time, there is great solidarity among believers, even people who are wary of proselytization, who don't necessarily feel that they share or interact with members of the other religion in their life, say that they have some sort of solidarity for believers. So Tanzania was an interesting case, high social distrust, but yet this sense that religion and coming together around religion could play a positive role in some sense. And finally, Zambia. It had very low perceptions of religious and ethnic conflict. Half the country said they saw no problems. But it was third highest, there were only Christian statistics for Zambia, given its 2% Muslim population. But it was the third highest among the few countries of Christians expressing dissatisfaction, particularly economic, but we know that economic, ethnic, and other concerns can often sort of get placed on or mixed or conflated with religion. So comparing these outliers, these sociological statistics and outlying attitudes made me wonder more about the role of perceptions, attitudes, and values in the interaction of law and religion. I use those three terms because I heard Andrew Kohut use those three terms in a talk that he gave presenting another recent Pew report on global Muslim attitudes. Perceptions seem to be what the Pew data are measuring. They're asking the questions, they're getting these immediate responses from people. But there's potentially a concern when perceptions harden into attitudes, and even more of a concern when attitudes harden into values. So the questions that I want to leave us with today are what does this resurgence of religion in the world, as some call it, and what in religious studies we are actually calling a post-secular era, what does that mean for law and religion? What role should law play in managing social hostilities? And what sort of social scientific understanding does law need of religion to do what's needed to affect that management and protect religious freedom and support human rights? Thank you very much.